Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, we're on a mission from God. Journalist and author Daniel Devise discusses his book, The Blues Brothers, An Epic Friendship, The Rise of Improv, and the Making of an American Classic. Hit it! The following conversation originally took place March 19th, 2024, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum.
I just wanted to say welcome to everyone who's here and to everybody who's watching online. We're glad you could join us tonight. My name is Gary Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. So if you like the kind of programs you see here at the museum, you can join us as a member and get free admission to all kinds of events, as well as discounted tickets to special things like our Get Lit Happy Hour series, which next month celebrates Poetry in Bloom for National Poetry Month. You can see our staff at the front desk or join online at AmericanWritersMuseum.org. Lastly, if you don't forget to join us next month for the launch of Sarah Paretsky's latest V.R. Warshawski novel, Pay Dirt, thank you all for being here and celebrating the past, present, future of American writing. Now, we're here tonight because we're on a mission for God. So opens The Blues Brothers, which hit theaters on June 20th, 1980. Their scripted mission was to save a local Chicago orphanage, but Dan Aykroyd, who conceived and wrote the film, had a greater mission: to honor the then seemingly forgotten tradition of rhythm and blues, some of whose greatest artists, Aretha Franklin, James Brown, John Lee Hooker, Cab Calloway, Ray Charles, made the film as unforgettable as its wild car chases. Late and vastly over budget, beset by mercurial and oft-drugged-out stars, The Blues Brothers opened to tepid reviews at best. However, in the 44 years since it has been acknowledged as a classic, it's been inducted in the National Film Registry for its cultural significance, even declared a Catholic classic by the church itself, even declared and re-aired thousands of times on television to huge worldwide audience. It is undeniably one of the most significant films of the 20th century. Here to talk about the making of the legendary film and his book, The Blues Brothers, is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Daniel Devise, author of King of the Blues, The Rise and Reign of B.B. King, as well as many other books. He'll be interviewed by Keith Phipps, culture writer and former editor of The Dissolve, The AV Club, and Up Rocks. Welcome to you both.
So I'll start by saying I really enjoyed the book. It is a small topic, one film, but you branch out to a lot of different places from there. I want to talk about at the beginning. It's the only book I know that began as an offshoot of a fact-checking expedition. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's right. hey, thank you guys for coming. So you go back to 2020, I was finishing up the B.B. King book. And I wanted to know why B.B. King wasn't in the Blues Brothers. He's kind of blues brother number one. And I had that hole in my reporting, and there didn't seem to be any credible reason why he wouldn't have been in the Blues Brothers. And my editor was interested in knowing as well. So I found John Landis's home phone number. you can find people sometimes that way. We were just talking about reaching famous people. It's difficult, but he was listed. He wasn't listed exactly. I had one of those, you pay $20 and, you know, sort of legal. And I called him, and he talked my ear off for about an hour. And we ended up talking three or four times for 3 or 4 hours over the course of 3 or 4 weeks. And over the course of those conversations, I guess by the time I was done with those calls, I kind of felt like I had the seed for another book, which was, he was talking and talking. He said, well, you know, Landis, you know, the real mission from God, you know, wasn't what you think. And he started talking about how Aykroyd really wanted to rebuild the fame of these icons of rhythm and blues. I'm not even sure if he knew which icons he wanted to resurrect, but you know, they'd all fallen on hard times. At the end of the 70s, you had the disco, you had the arena rock, you had the AC/DC and stuff like that, and Bee Gees, Andy Gibb. Remember the Comiskey Park, the burning, and Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer. And so Donald Fagen wrote, I think, and saying that hard times had fallen the sole survivors. And so it just was a really sweet story that Aykroyd wanted to resurrect their careers if he could, or help restore interest in them. And so, yeah, that's why I wrote the book. Also, I was in touch with Landis at that point. He was a big yakker, and I knew I could get him on the phone. And he was a treasure. He was so, the book would never, ever, ever have happened without him.
So you ended up basically writing a dual biography, at least up to a certain point in these Ben's lives. At what point did you realize it was going to go that deep into their childhoods and the whole what brought them to the Blues Brothers to begin with?
I consciously copied a formula from an earlier book. I haven't written that many books, but I've written four solo books and five total. One was co-written. And my greatest hit, if you will, is the book about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts, which is called Andy and Don. I still get royalty checks from it. Decent ones, you know. And that was a formula. I told the life story of each guy, and then when they intersect and become friends, then I tell their story together. And then the big centerpiece of the book is the Andy Griffith Show, which you could argue was certainly their greatest joint work. You might say it's the greatest work of either guy, although you have the face in the crowd for Andy. But anyway, and then I plot out the rest of their lives until they're both deceased. So I did the same thing with this book, and my editor wasn't very, I think he was a little concerned when he found out I wasn't just writing a book about the movie, because usually books about movies are about the movie, and usually you get to the movie pretty quick in the book about the movie. And I didn't. I spent a very long time talking about Belushi's childhood in Wheaton, Illinois, and then his getting into Second City and moving into the city and becoming a real Chicagoan and becoming somewhat well-known and getting written about in the Daily News and all that, and then going to New York and working for Lemmings and Lampoon and then Aykroyd, and I have him growing up in Ottawa and getting into Second City in Toronto with that very famous cast, the folks from Schitt's Creek and John Candy and all them. And there's a great lot that happens before the film gets made, but the film becomes the big deep dive centerpiece to the book. It's like 100 pages right in the center of the book. And I was just gambling that you'd care a lot more about these two guys if you read something about their coming up, and their stories are fascinating. Just fascinating. And the same thing with Andy and Don, fascinating life stories. So you get a modest dual biography up to the point where they're together and they're at Saturday Night Live and they create the Blues Brothers, and then we have the film. And then in this case, I didn't know where I was going to end, so I don't exactly follow the Andy and Don formula, because I stopped writing basically after Belushi died because I didn't think there was anything more to say. So after that, there's a tiny little epilogue, and that's the end.
Mm-hmm. I feel like, to a certain extent, both men's lives have been told before, and certainly early days of Saturday Night Live, but I found, a lot I had not heard before. What surprised you? We'll start with Belushi. What surprised you most when you were researching Belushi's background and childhood?
Well, it's an interesting point. The people who are really embedded in these different subjects, from their perspective, there's a shelf full of books about Belushi and Aykroyd and the Blues Brothers and Animal House and, Caddyshack and all that. And that's true. But I think the average person out there probably hasn't read there's a Belushi biography by Bob Woodward, mm-hmm. which was a big deal in the 80s, but that was the 80s. And I didn't feel like there was really a Belushi bio since then, and there's never really been an Aykroyd bio. So I felt like I was kind of safe, like that nobody's going to say, oh, I've read all this before. And probably the Belushi story is better known, but he was the bigger star, the sort of meteoric star. But you didn't ask that question. You asked me what I heard that I didn't know. I mean,
answer whatever you want.
Let me think for a second. What did I not? I didn't know very much about either one of them. I mean, I don't think when I started writing the book, I don't know that I knew that Belushi was from Wheaton. Mm-hmm. I knew that Aykroyd was from Canada. I don't think I knew that there was this really interesting parallel of them both being really into music when they were young, both being really into improvising, even when they're supposed to be doing scripted things on stage. And so they both got in trouble for that. Both got into Second City I sort of knew that, but there's a really very satisfying parallel in their careers. I didn't know how close they really were in real life. I thought they probably were, but I didn't know for sure until I researched the book. Gosh, I didn't know how kind of scary, like, smart Ackroyd is. I think he's kind of sort of, as one of the sources say in the book, sort of genius-ish, you know, and maybe also a little bit on the spectrum, just by his own count. And Belushi's, there's all sorts of fascinating qualities of Belushi that I didn't know. But yeah, so there was really more that I didn't know than I did. So why do this book at all? Well, that's not the question you asked, so I'll say that.
Well, I'll tell you what struck me was I didn't realize that part of the Belushi story was that transformative summer at the Indiana theater camp, where he basically went in as sort of a straight and narrow person who didn't indulge in substances and left as a kind of full-fledged hippie at that point, right? If I read it correctly.
Yeah, that's another thing. That's right. I didn't know any of this. He was a gridiron great at Wheaton Central High School, a jock, a teetotaler. And in fact, he turned in the quarterback for drinking beer. Mm. I mean, think about that for a moment. John Belushi. And then he, let's see. Yes, he spends the summer at the Shawnee Theater with a bunch of hippie actors, and very quickly, there's a great passage in the book from Mark Kurlansky, who's a great writer, who wrote the book Salt, and I think he wrote a book called Cod. Then those are different books, and they're both really, really good books. Great writer. Mark Kurlansky was in this summer stock theater, and he described the first time Belushi like had a beer. They went to this naval base. For some reason, there's a naval base in the middle of Indiana, landlocked, and that he watched Belushi drink a beer and just like turn into like the Tasmanian devil. And it was clear to him Belushi had a substance issue. So Belushi got into beer and he got into weed and he grew his hair out. And yes, he was a hippie when he returned from that summer theater. And you're right, that's exactly when it happened. And then after that, he's, you know, army jacket, demonstrating, you know, at the police riot. And he's Second City's sort of resident hippie, kind of replacing Harold Ramis, who had been sort of the resident hippie and went on a sabbatical.
And with Ackroyd, I was really struck by the childhood. The you can describe it better than I can. The long walks to school, for starters, and like sort of that odd double culture of being in Ottawa, but also being close to Quebec, if I got the geography right there.
Yeah, he was from an old English family, multi-generational English family that had moved to Canada. And his father was in civil service, you know, I think somewhat highly placed. I think they were, you know, fairly upper crust. He worked on the Gatineau Parkway and was in Ottawa, the capital. And, you know, right across the river was French speakers, was Quebec. And he would get beat up when he walked to school by Quebecois youths. And I picture Ackroyd as being a really complex character, because I think he had all this erudition from his old family and you know, kind of aristocratic family. But he also cultivated all these sort of alter egos, sort of everyman. He loved police and would hang out with off-duty cops. He opened a speakeasy when he was in college and just loved hanging out with cops and truck drivers and sort of hooligans. And so he sort of seemed fascinated by the sort of underclass and the underbelly of society. And the great line from Rosie Schuster's brother, I think Rosie told me it was her brother who first said this, was that Ackroyd's ultimate fantasy would be to commit a crime and then arrest himself.
Yeah, not to in any way to diminish these Belushi and Ackroyd's contributions, but it is remarkable that they are just surrounded at three different junctures on the map by these incredibly talented people that went on to their own levels of fame too. There's Chicago here, Second City in Toronto with all the SCTV people and future Saturday Night Live people, and then Saturday Night Live itself. I mean, what was what was going on? Like, what?
It makes it seem like the entertainment world was really small, because but that's not the case. I think these were just insane concentrations of talent in Chicago. Second City, the Next Generation. I mean, there's a lot of great people from Second City, but this is a good group. It was Harold Ramis, Joe Flaherty, again, Belushi, And I'm forgetting some names, but the rest of them were no slouches. It was a very strong company. People at the time, I think, said it was one of the first really great companies since the old days, you know, the Alan Arkin days, the Elaine May days. And then in Toronto, you had arguably even more illustrious group, and I'm going to miss names, but between Second City, Toronto, and the Godspell production in Toronto, you had Gilda, you had John Short. Candy, Martin Short, help me, guys.
Victor Garber.
Paul Schaefer, Joe Flaherty, Eugene Levy, and Catherine O'Hara, who started out as a waitress. Just an amazing group of performers, and a bunch of them were in that little fire hall cast at the same time, and just an astonishing group. Yeah. Lampoon.
Right, of course, I left one out.
Lampoon, Lemmings, you get Chevy Chase, Belushi, and a little later on, Harold Ramis joined that group, and so did Flaherty, so did Gilda, and there were other, Chris Guest, yeah, who didn't become famous until quite a bit later, but a lot of you know who he is through these wonderful films he did, starting with Spinal Tap. Wonderful, wonderful group.
And, I was struck also by wherever they went, they seemed to kind of set up their own bar. That was a hangout spot. There was a 505 in Toronto, and then there was one here by Second City as well, right?
Yeah, I think Aykroyd, again, he's a very complex guy, and I think he liked being entrepreneurial, and he set up the speakeasy because the bars in Toronto all closed rather early, and the Second City performers wanted to get a drink at 1 or 2 in the morning. And so Aykroyd just started a speakeasy, and he quickly won over the local law enforcement. They would come drink at his bar. Think about Aykroyd. He looks kind of like a cop, and they loved him. And so he had them as his customers. And so then at Saturday Night Live a few years later, I would say the episode when the Grateful Dead were on, 77 maybe, 78, one of those years, they opened the Blues Bar near the Holland Tunnel, which was another speakeasy, basically, and only SNL hipsters and the guests and people like Keith Richards were allowed, and they would hang out there, and it was apparently really scungy, and it was just this crazy alternate after party, alternate to the after party that Lorne Michaels threw, which was more straight-laced, I guess. I'm sure there was probably cocaine at both, but at the Blues Bar, it was just a scungy dive, and it was the young people, right? It was Bill Murray and Gilda Radner and Aykroyd, Belushi, the Grateful Dead, Keith Richards, ZZ Top, people like that.
These are very different people. I mean, they emerge in your book as very different characters, and yet extremely compatible both artistically, and they became great friends. How'd that happen? What did you kind of get a sense of why they work together so well, both as performers and as friends?
I think they were in friendship terms. They were kind of like soulmates. Once they met, they were just bound together. Aykroyd found Belushi just fascinating, and I think Belushi felt very grounded with Aykroyd. That's a good question. I kind of use their own words to describe it, but they became kind of like office spouses in a way. They wrote together. They had an office together. Judy was John's partner in marriage and in love, but I think Aykroyd became kind of his partner in everything else. And it's a little hard to explain. Like, Don Knotts and Andy Griffith, what did they have in common, really? They're very different people, but they just adored, especially Andy just adored Don, and Don came to really love Andy. And I think with Belushi and Aykroyd, I think they really adored each other, and they just became sort of best buds, kind of like soulmates, but in a purely sort of platonic, bromance sort of way.
I was struck also by Belushi was always a music fan, but he was not a blues R&B soul fan. It was Aykroyd who introduced him to that. And as you write, kind of introduced him into the music in Chicago when they were together in Toronto. That was a neat detail to me that one didn't necessarily expect to encounter.
Right. So they both were frustrated musicians. They'd both played the drums. They'd both played sort of like in high school bands. I think in Aykroyd's case, he would hang out around the clubs around Ottawa and even sit in with bands and stuff. Belushi was in a band in Wheaton. And then with Lemmings, Belushi was, you know, made full use of his somewhat limited instrumental abilities. So they were frustrated musicians. And the night they met in Toronto, which was, I think, in the autumn of 74, Belushi's trying to get Aykroyd to come join Lampoon. And they talk about music, and Belushi's like, what's this stuff? And Aykroyd's like, this is the blues, man. You know, you're from Chicago, you know. And Belushi's, oh, I like, you know, Led Zeppelin. And but they get to talking, and they kind of say, oh, we should form a band someday. And what's his name, the guy who's the musical director from Saturday Night Live?
Howard Shore.
Howard Shore says, and you should call yourselves the Blues Brothers. Now, Howard Shore didn't remember saying that when I asked him, but everybody says that happened that night. So, and then, but there was more to that, because so on the first season of Saturday Night Live, they start doing this kind of blues duo act, which is really Aykroyd's thing more, and kind of warming up the audience before the show, and then they go on live TV dressed as bees late in the first season and do a blues number, but it was all kind of half-baked. And then my sense of it, Aykroyd was a little vague on this, but I think they kind of the characters kind of hibernated for a year or two. And then Belushi went to Oregon to film Animal House, and he met a cat named Curtis Salgado, who was a big blues guy who performed in a band with Robert Cray, who was an emerging guitar guy, now pretty famous. And Salgado really turned Belushi on to the blues big time. And so when Belushi came back from that, and that would have been the autumn of 1977, he was suddenly on this big blues bender. And so then both of them were really, really into the blues, Aykroyd and Belushi. And this is where you get the full tilt Blues Brothers debuting live on SNL in April of 78, which is a few months after the Animal House shoot.
And in the book, you write about how the reaction was, is this a joke or is this for real? And I don't feel like that question's ever really been answered in a way, because they're comedy people, but they were very sincere about this music. But I'm not sure how seriously they took themselves, and yet they were quite invested at the same time. I mean, do you have an answer to that question?
Well, here's a thought. Somebody's interviewing last week and pointed out, who else, who were like a big television star, went out on tour with like a big musical act? Has that happened? Had that happened before the Blues Brothers and became this real band that went out on a big tour? Had that happened before? I it's a little complicated, because you have people going back and forth between being pop stars and being film or television stars. But these guys weren't musical performers, really. Not like, I'm thinking of the people who were really great musical performers who also acted. This wasn't that. They weren't great musical performers. They just decided they were one day and put together this crack band and went out on tour. It's weird and sort of unprecedented, perhaps. But I've strayed a bit from your question yet again.
I think you're on the right path.
Yeah, it must have been strange. And so when Belushi and Aykroyd, who aren't great musical performers, are suddenly like acting like they're serious musical performers all of a sudden, people were baffled and didn't know what to make of it. And it's kind of a surprise. But then when that fall they opened for Steve Martin and did, you know, 9 shows at the Universal Amphitheater, it was a huge response, and people loved their serious rhythm and blues act. And so I guess maybe that right there said, okay, I guess it's a success, you know?
Yeah, and rewatching the movie and thinking about the Blues Brothers in general, they're not really characters until the movie, are they? There's no real backstory. They're just performers at that point on Saturday Night Live.
So I think there's an answer to that. They were both really into the Blues Brothers act. I think they would have been happy to right then and there just leave Saturday Night Live and be musical stars, because they both were frustrated musicians, but it wouldn't have happened in a normal world. Belushi was huge because of Animal House. So there was no question there was going to be another Belushi movie. It was just, what movie is that going to be? Because Animal House was enormous, and Belushi was by far the big draw in that. So I think when the time came to figure out what's going to be the next Belushi film, it was pretty obvious it was going to be these goofy Blues Brothers characters, because that's what they're really into right now. So let's let them do a movie. And I don't think anybody knew what it was going to be exactly, but it's a credit to Aykroyd that he came up with a story, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the origin is the script is credited to Landis and Aykroyd, but Aykroyd is the original story, right? The
324-page script. Yeah, enough for a few movies.
Yeah, for a page of a script is basically a minute of film time, yeah. So that's not a film that's going to happen.
And then it bounced back and forth. And Landis contributed a lot of great stuff, but the spine of the story was Aykroyd's.
Yeah, and a Chicago story, too. I don't know that you necessarily get into this in the book so much, but how did, you know, was it ever not going to be a Chicago story? Was it the Blues Brothers always going to be a Chicago story?
Yeah, I think Aykroyd saw it as set there. He went out on a road trip well before he even wrote the script, and he kind of made a beeline for Chicago and environs, and I think that was out of his love for Belushi. He just loved Belushi, thought Belushi was a fascinating and great guy, lovable guy, and loved that he was from Chicago, and Aykroyd's a huge blues fan, so I think the idea gravitated to Chicago and was never not going to be in Chicago.
And it seems like they kind of had, in some ways, Animal House bought them a lot of money to make this movie as well. I was thinking if this had gone another way, this could be 1941 or it could be Ishtar. You know, it could be talking about this sort of maybe a cult favorite that was a huge failure at the time.
Yeah.
I wonder what gave them the confidence that, you know, we're going to make a musical that ends in. Is it an hour-long car chase? I'm not even sure.
God, yeah, I mean, and let's remember, the film got panned by a lot of critics when it came out. You can go down the list from Time and Newsweek, Washington Post, New York Times. All of them hated it. So a lot of people at the time thought it was a 1941. I mean, except that it did really well. It sold a lot of tickets. It was a huge success at the box office. And then years later came the critical reappraisal. I mean, I don't really remember. I guess I would say that when I was in high school in the 80s, I thought it was a great film, and I think it was well liked. But certainly when it came out, it was hated. You know, it was seen as emblematic of all that was wrong with Hollywood: gross overspending and, you know, big budget, empty. You know, like a lot of the films today. You know, it's funny because it seems like pretty small potatoes to spend $30 million on a movie, but it was considered to be this just excess, wretched excess.
And it might not have happened if it weren't for Jane Byrne being mayor at the time, correct?
Yeah, as I understand it, and Chris Borelli from the Chicago Tribune interviewed her, and I'm sure asked her about this a long time ago for a big story, great story he did. I remember this. Mayor Daley's cronies didn't like her and would kind of ridicule her and were sexist, you know, and called her names. And I think she maybe delighted in the idea of having a convoy roll over Daley Plaza. and so she opened up the film industry. There had been a film, again, Borelli wrote about this beautifully, there had been a film industry a long time ago, a long time earlier. I guess there was some cop show that did some kind of dirty cop episode or something in Chicago, and Mayor Daley hit the roof, and so he sort of canceled all filmmaking in the city for like 20 years. But Mayor Byrne opened it back up again, and then you got all these wonderful films after that, you know, the John Hughes films and The Fugitive, and you can name more than I can.
No, yeah, I mean, if you go through a list of films made in Chicago, and it dries up in the 60s and 70s, there's a handful.
Yeah.
The Fury was made shortly before
The Fury,
that, but yeah, and The Hunter at the same time as Blues Brothers.
What about The Bodyguard? My Bodyguard, was that before?
Yeah, that was 1980, so it probably been filmed kind of around the same time.
I remember liking that one.
Yeah, me too. That was a favorite as a kid. There's basically two elements beyond Belushi and Aykroyd. There's two elements to talk about with the film, which are the stunts or the music. So which do you want to get to first?
Music.
Let's do the music. Okay, so B.B. King is not in it. Maybe you can tell. Can you walk us through maybe what the selection process was like for what musical artists were in the film, and is there anyone they could not get?
Yeah, I got the sense from talking to Landis that Aykroyd maybe didn't know specifically who he wanted. He loved all of these artists and would have been happy to see any of them, their sales lifted, or, you know, from this movie. And Aykroyd and Landis, I think maybe together, plotted, you know, well, here are some guys we could get. We know who was in the film. Landis met personally with most of them and talked them into being in it. They weren't very successful at the time, a lot of them. They were on a downslide for the most part, so it wasn't hard to get them to be in the movie. They wanted B.B. King. As I said, Landis tried to get B.B. King. Well, I didn't say this. Landis did try to get B.B. King, and B.B.'s manager waved him off, said he's too busy. But years later, B.B. found out that he'd missed out on this, and he was crushed. He was really disappointed. They did get Muddy Waters, but I guess he fell ill right before the shoot on Maxwell Street. And so it would have been Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, and probably would have had Boom Boom and also, you know, Manish Boy or whatever. Would have been cool. And then they tried to get Little Richard before they got James Brown for The Preacher. But as I said, I wrote an article for USA Today about this. He had his own mission from God. He was very, very spiritual at that point, and so he didn't think it was right for him to be in the film. And I think that's everybody. There may have been other people they approached. Chaka Khan is in it very briefly. But I was telling Landis, I mean, I don't know that they'd sorted out who was in the Pantheon as clearly in 1979. So, I mean, it's to their credit that they got James Brown, Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Cab Calloway. I mean, I think I said in the epilogue, if Duke Ellington had still been around, I'm sure they would have gotten him. So they just got some of the absolute greats. And I don't know if time had sorted out everyone by then, by that, the late 70s. But now we know, I mean, there's no one bigger than Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and James Brown. And they all are immortalized in that film, which I think is a lot of the reason why the film is sort of immortal, because of them being in it, you know.
There's not a doubt in the bunch. The one that always surprises me, even, you know, having seen the film, is like Cab Calloway. I mean, this is a generation back, yeah, even from everybody else, and he's very lively. It's a really exciting performance as well.
It was an inspired choice.
Yeah.
And he's got a decent part. He's the, you know, the mentor guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Do you have a favorite performance? Is there one that stands out for you as your particular favorite?
It changes. Lately, I've been really into the John Lee Hooker performance.
Mm.
But probably overall, my favorite might be the Aretha Franklin one. But just as cinematography, the Ray Charles one is lovely. I said in the book, it's like a Robert Crumb cartoon come to life, all the people dancing on the street.
It's also, I mean, it's such a time capsule of the Chicago that was, particularly Maxwell Street. It just, I mean, I'm sure it was dressed for the film, but what an invaluable,
yeah,
document of just a space that's just not there anymore.
Yeah, yeah, it's beautiful. It's funny because people, a few interviews have asked, what's your favorite scene from the movie? And it's funny, I've been answering this or that scene, but I keep forgetting the musical scenes, which are like everyone's favorites. I mean, so I kind of put those in one category. And then what's my other favorite scenes that don't involve those artists? And then you get to, like, you know, then you get to the Shea Paul, you know, that sort of stuff.
So the stunts. I was, you know, it's strange. In some ways, it shouldn't be strange, but it's strange to see real stunts in a movie, you know, given our current action film environment. I mean, to see, there's really nothing, you can't really fake just cars colliding into one another, yeah, realistically. A car dropped from a helicopter, which, what an insane thing to do.
Yeah, you know, they had a yard where they rebuilt a lot of those cars, so they didn't actually destroy, like, more than 100 vehicles. A lot of cars got destroyed and then fixed up and then destroyed again. And my sense is, I'm not a film writer. My sense is that they followed all of the safety standards of the day, which are different from the safety standards now. I'm not aware of anyone having gotten seriously injured on the shoot, which is important to say. But yeah, some of that stuff looks pretty crazy. I wrote in the Sun Times about how when they were filming inside the mall, you know, that was fumes, just noxious fumes from the exhaust, right? And burning rubber, and not to mention the rotting produce at the jewel store, because it was just sitting there day after day after day. And it was a sealed space because it was supposed to be night. So they'd sealed all the doors and windows. And so they had to just kind of pile out the doors every so often just to gasp for breath. And I don't think that would be part of a film shoot today, you know?
Yeah, I think safety standards have changed on that on that front as well. We talked a little bit about the reception, but you actually went and talked to some of the critics that reviewed at the time,
yeah,
didn't you?
Janet Maslin, yeah. Right. A few of them are quoted. The typical response was, wow, was I that negative? some of them, the great guy from The Reader, Jonathan Rosenbaum, I get the sense he still doesn't like the film. So I got nowhere with him. But I interviewed several other people who had trashed it, big names. And you know, they like it now. They like it more. Although I think Janet Maslin said, well, you know, there was aspects technically of the filmmaking process in that film that was not great. But they all sort of conceded, okay, well, it's a much better regarded film now. Yeah.
We touched on this a little bit, but what do you feel like, what do you feel the film's lasting legacy is? I mean, it's a great Chicago film. It's a great music film. It's sort of a, you know, captures these two performers at the height of their charisma, and unfortunately ends up being one of the last performances from Belushi, who didn't have too much longer.
Yeah.
So when you think of this film, what's the first thing that comes to mind for you?
Well, I think the most important part of it is its role as an artifact of the work of James Brown and Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and Cab Calloway and John Lee Hooker. I think that's the most important part of the film. And the love that our heroes had for them. And you know, I think partly the dark sunglasses was because they didn't want to be front and center in the film. They wanted to show these great people, you know, and their legs turned to jelly when they're around Aretha. They're terrified, you know. And then beyond that, if you take all that aspect, that fascinating, conflicting sort of racial thing out of the movie. Because remember, they were accused of racism by a number of writers, like in Rolling Stone and the alternative press. Like, how dare they enlist these greats in minor roles and then star in the movie themselves? But if you take the racial aspect out of it, what makes it a very good film, so it would have been a very good film anyway, is, yeah, as the showcase of Aykroyd and Belushi, this wonderful friendship at the height of their powers, although Belushi was fading, but I think it's certainly their great work. I think it represents some of the greatest work of Belushi, along, I guess, with Animal House, but Blues Brothers has aged a lot better than Animal House. You can watch it all the way through without wincing at the, you know, there's no objectification of women in it that I can think of. I think it's one of the great Chicago films. Somebody in a local publication said a while ago, and I love this, that the Blues Brothers is Ferris Bueller if you're rich, and the Chicago is Ferris Bueller if you're rich, and Chicago is the Blues Brothers if you're poor. For me, it's maybe more of a city suburbs thing, because I never felt the same connection to any of the John Hughes films, because I wasn't from the suburbs. I was from the city, so I felt much more of a connection to the Blues Brothers. So it's a great Chicago film. I think it's the best work of John Landis, who's one of our great comedy directors. Is American Werewolf a comedy? I'm not sure if that's a comedy exactly, but it's a great film. But he's a great director. He had 5 wonderful films in a row, and then some more really great films after that. But the ones through Trading Places, I think, is the last of this amazing run that he had. What else? Gosh, I mean, it's probably the best film to have been inspired by anything that was on Saturday Night Live. I may be missing something. I think as a film with a SNL person in it, it's up there, I think, with Groundhog Day, which is a brilliant film. But Groundhog Day isn't a Saturday Night Live film. It's just a Bill Murray film, but it's of that group, you know. So yeah, it's a wonderful film, but I think what makes it immortal is the rhythm and blues performances, you know. And the Blues Brothers band, yes, but Aretha, James Brown, Ray Charles.
Yeah, I think whatever, in some ways, it's also its own kind of redemption story in a way, because some of those criticisms of them kind of playing at being soul musicians seem pretty valid until you get something like this that kind of immortalizes and in many ways restores some of these careers.
What I always, if anybody asks me this question, and I've been asked it a lot in the last several weeks, and this is the God's truth. After I saw the Blues Brothers probably the first or second time, I did not go to the store, Rose Records, you know, on Ashland, and buy the Blues Brothers record. I did not. I went and bought The Best of Sam and Dave, which became maybe was that my first rhythm and blues record ever? It might have been. This is not like 1981 or something. I probably had a couple Otis Redding and Aretha Franklin records, but barely any, and so this seeded a collection. So and I think that's what the boys would have wanted.
Since I get to, I think we've talked through the whole thing. Anything else you want to talk about with this? Anything I've missed?
Oh gosh, no. thank you for interviewing me. We'd love to take your questions, and I hope one of us can answer them.
Awesome. So thank you. So great interview. Blues Brothers has been my favorite movie since I can ever remember. It's awesome to hear where you ended the book, because I continued on this journey, and I wanted to ask what you thought about two more recent additions to the Blues Brothers family, and that would have been that I was immensely disappointed about Blues Brothers 2000, and then if you did attend the Blues Brothers con that was at Statesville Prison a couple of years ago.
I know about it.
Both of those things.
Thank you. Well, one thing I'll say about Blues Brothers 2000, I think that around the time it came out was around the time that the critics started to really feel the Blues Brothers, to really warm to the Blues Brothers. There were some of the reviews of Blues Brothers 2000, which was not a great film, pointed out that it'll never measure up to the classic original. And I think it's around then that people, at least in the movie critic business, started to realize that, wow, that was a classic film. And maybe it took a not as good sequel to bring that point home. I was dismissive of Blues Brothers 2000 in the B.B. King book. And I felt bad about it after because, you know, Landis, I mean, spent a lot of time and effort and poured his heart into that film, and there's some great stuff in it. I shouldn't have just dismissed it, but I like that there's still, that the Blues Brothers are still a going concern. But, you know, they didn't know it when they when Aykroyd and Belushi played at Poplar Creek in like July of 1980. They didn't know at the time that was the last time they were going to do the thing together. I think it's probably a good thing that, in a way, the franchise has been retired as far as, like, I don't think I'd want to see five more Blues Brothers films, you know. But I like that the act goes on, and there's Blues Brothers act all over now. I think they have different spellings to their names and stuff, but that's kind of cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there a particular reason Landis cast James Brown as the preacher?
Well, it was originally going to be Little Richard, and he was a preacher, I think, in real life, so that would have been apropos. But the part went to James Brown, and he was apparently thrilled to have it. And of course, he made great work of it. I think they had to do some of the vocals over that spectacular shoot in the church, which is so energetic, was wonderful. But I think, you know, I think they had to re-record some of the vocals. But he did a great job. But why him? I think maybe he was a natural choice. He probably the only other person with the energy level of Little Richard, you know. And one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, thanks for the interview. That was great. And I read that the Sun-Times article. That was a good article.
I wrote that.
Did you? That was great. And especially the glass counters. I was looking for that in the movie. I watched it last night. I couldn't see it.
Just very briefly, they're not actually snorting coke in that shot.
Okay.
But they're... Very briefly, you see them fooling around at the glass countertop. They're clearly doing something goofy. A couple of the guys in the band told me to watch that scene and see if I can find this funny thing, and I had no idea what they were talking about. If you look very closely, and in the book, I explain exactly where it is. It's at a certain point in that scene when they're in the shop. There's guys fooling around at the glass counter, and that's what they were doing. They were pretending to cut up cocaine.
So where's John Landis from?
Chicago.
Is he really? Because he really portrayed, you know, Block 37. I'm looking at it. I'm going, it's gone, you know, and the only thing left is that substation, the ComEd substation there in that block in the movie.
Well, he grew up in L.A. near the military cemetery, near, I think, maybe Westwood. But his family was from Chicago, I think the South Side, probably the Hyde Park area. Marshall Landis was his father. He was an interior decorator, I think. Died when John was like six. And they came to Chicago and sure as heck seemed like they knew the city really well. Landis wouldn't have had a huge working knowledge of the city, but, well, other people in the cast or crew, they'd spent a lot of time scouting locations. And that's a good, you know, I've always heard these great questions I should have asked Landis and Bob Weiss, the producer, who's not from Chicago, I don't think, and Sosna, the assistant director, and these other guys, how did they how did they have such a great feel for the city? Because I didn't ask that question. It's a very good question. I guess I was probably thinking, well, Belushi's from Chicago and Aykroyd, it was like his adopted home or something. But yeah, they sure seemed like they knew the city inside and out. But there were location scouts crisscrossing the city looking for stuff. And it had that pitch perfect feel for the city, I think. You're right.
Yeah, it showed a real love for the city.
Yeah.
One last question, please. You bristled when they mentioned the Pulitzer Prize. That's a big deal. What was it in? What category?
It's because I only have a piece of a Pulitzer Prize. It was a team Pulitzer Prize. I'm very grateful for it. I do have a byline in a story that is a Pulitzer Prize winner, but it was probably a dozen of us. Elian Gonzalez. It was the raid where he was liberated. I reported that story, and the Miami Herald won a Pulitzer Prize for Spot News for that story.
Thank you.
Question from online. Were there many, many takes on some of the music scenes with Belushi and Aykroyd, or could they just nail it in one take?
I would say not many, many, but there were multiple takes. Aretha, for some reason, was struggling with the lyrics to her song. And Kaplan, the sound guy, wrote them on a like big screen or board, whiteboard, but then she didn't have her glasses. Old people problems, right? She wasn't that old, but yeah, I would have the same problem. So I'm guessing that they had a number of iterations of that scene. I'm pretty sure with James Brown as well. I don't know for certain, and here's another thing. I didn't ask anybody exactly how many times did you shoot these different scenes. I don't get the feel that very many of them came together like in one take. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts in some of these scenes. So I think they know that they spent multiple days doing them, which tells me multiple takes.
I was just curious through your research if you noticed anything that showed a connection between Aykroyd choosing Chicago and Mike Myers 12 years later choosing Chicago.
Oh, Canadians like Chicago. Yeah. Aykroyd had come down here in this August of 74. He may have come in August of 73 for an exchange program with Second City. There was write-ups in the Tribune of him and Gilda and John Candy, frolicking outside the Art Institute or something. So I think he'd fallen in love with the city on that visit. Aykroyd claimed that he'd read somewhere about a proposal to tax the Catholic Church. I couldn't find any such story in 1974. Chris Borelli at the Tribune could find no such story in 1974, but Aykroyd swore he heard it. The funny thing is, there was a little thread of stories about a proposal to tax something in the Catholic Church in the Illinois legislature, but it was actually after Aykroyd had written the script. It was like in 79. So it was proposed at least once, but it's silly, it's ridiculous. And that was the plot, is that they're going to tax the orphanage owed a tax bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I got one more, actually. It's kind of like, connected to that, it's kind of now, unless you lived through it or researched it, you've kind of forgotten that the Illinois Nazi Party was ripped from headlines, from actual events. It seems almost, if you don't know that, it almost seems like a fanciful invention.
Yeah. I had to ask Landis about this over and over again because I was struggling to piece that whole Skokie thing together. Did it end up happening in Skokie or was it in the city? I can't even remember. But it was postponed and relocated, and I had to make very sure that I got it right what actually happened. But yes, it was very much in the public knowledge. So they put it in the film. I will say this is kind of interesting. Harold Ramis, who also is from Chicago, I think had put the Nazi thing in an early draft of the Animal House script. Either that or they were talking about doing a movie around, a comedy movie around a Nazi rally. So, and it was based also on Skokie. So it wasn't an original idea, I don't think, to Landis and Aykroyd, but it's a great scene. And unscripted, when the cop says that, Nazi party, he wasn't supposed to drop that F-bomb, and I love it. It's one of my favorite lines in the film.
Hi, I have a question. Cab Calloway, when he did the Minnie the Moocher scene, is really great, but I had heard a story that he was looking to do like a disco version?
Yes.
Yeah, and he was very upset when they insisted that he do more of
the real song.
And so that was my first question, if he had heard that. And I was wondering if he had heard any other stories or anecdotes about some of the artists trying to maybe step out of role and demonstrate their that they were, what would you call it, you know, contemporary for the day.
Well, it's kind of fascinating. Everybody was doing songs with disco beats at that time just to stay alive. Staying alive. And Paul Schaefer educated us all on X a few months ago. Paul Schaefer in a tweet explained that what disco is, it's that bass drum on every beat. That's disco. You know, jive talking. Boom, doom, doom, doom. Yeah, that's the disco beat. So James Brown had the original Disco Man album. They were all desperately trying to do anything disco. So yes, Cab did want to do his discified Minnie the Moocher. Landis talked him out of it. Whether he was upset, I don't really know. I don't know that I asked Landis that question, but you know, cooler heads prevailed. And I also know that Aretha wanted to do Respect, but they'd written Think into the script. Mm-hmm. It made sense, so they talked her into doing that. I'm not sure either performer quite understood why they didn't want them to do kind of what was their big hit of the moment, because Cab Calloway had had a minor hit, I think, with this disco-fied Minnie the Moocher. There's a great black and white cartoon of Minnie the Moocher. If you have a chance to see it on YouTube, look up Minnie the Moocher, Cab Calloway on YouTube. There's this amazing, phantasmagoric black and white cartoon from like the 30s, and it'll blow your mind. It's really interesting. That, cool. Did you have another question?
No, that was it, but thank you. It was a great interview. Thanks.
Thank you.
And, I think with that, we can all say thank you to Daniel.
Thank you. And,
thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.